Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. What issue are we on, Cole? I don't even know.
Yeah, the thing about it is, we are on the next issue.
I want to say 87.
I want to say that you're right, because what's still throwing us, what's still, you know, at the edge, the elephant in the room, I guess, is what became of that 82 or 83, whichever issue that is that went missing.
Well, the footage is at the Smithsonian right now.
Yeah.
So
we are waiting for that to be declassified and turned back over to us.
I don't know why we turned it over to the Smithsonian of all places.
And apparently once you do that, you don't simply,
Right, I think that was a mistake. We should have followed our second instinct on that, and not the Smithsonian.
Yeah,
it was a little bit of delusion of grandeur on our part, thinking that the Smithsonian would want it.
Yeah, but enough. Even the stuff they don't want, they hold on.
Right.
There's a whole process. Apparently, when the institution was established, that was the key tenet of Smithsonian's directive when he bequeathed the land and established the institute.
They're kind of dicks. A little bit dickish. But what are you going to do? I mean, they're the Smithsonian.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you want to rock that boat and be banned for life?
Right.
I might like to go back one of these days.
Right, I agree. I agree.
And in answer to the pressing question at the moment, it is in fact Hey Kids Comics number 87.
It is 87. All right.
87, where we are going to, if we're at all fortunate here, I think it's almost sort of a companion piece to last week.
It is. It is. It what we're doing, Cole had the genius idea of doing a show about. And I'm gonna at least a little bit throw a monkey wrench in it, just a little bit, you know. I've gotta declare my own little dominance over things, you know. I've got an ego.
It is. I mean, at the end of the day, it is and should be your show.
I got a little bit of an ego. I was washing my cat today. Didn't have much time to think about it, but you know, and I think Cole is in the same mind as I am. But Cole came to me with this idea for a show called Space Race. Which is a companion to the time travel show we did yesterday. Did we do it yesterday? It feels
it seems yesterday. Like yesterday, but oddly enough, it was not.
It was almost a week ago.
Yes, it was.
Which, explain your idea for the show, Cole.
Well, actually, you know, initially the concept, I think it was called something like Out of This World or, you know, something along those lines. And the idea was that you would have an in-depth discussion about all the extraterrestrial types, both heroes, villains, ancillary characters. The fact that every comic universe worth its salt, and even a lot of the ones that aren't worth a darn, all seem to, you know, one of the core things you can get away with. If you're willing to buy into superheroes, as the Avengers have learned in the cinematic universe, in time, you learn to you have to embrace outer space. Basically, you have to embrace extraterrestrial life, and most times, more intelligent than you are, or more advanced than you are.
One would think. Right?
Yeah, but then I got thinking about last week's discussions, and I realized that time and space tend to go hand in hand.
They are very relative to each other. I agree.
They vacation separately, but they are very often seen together. And with that in mind, I realized, you know, we really need to kind of tackle both as companion subjects.
I could not agree more.
And that's really what this was born out of, is that concept that what do you follow? The trouble with time travel with is the fact that I have very little trouble with space travel.
Okay.
And space aliens, if you will.
See, here's my take on it, right? I really want to get into, and as I was thinking about this and you know, I got the pitch and I'm like, this is a good idea. I really like it. What really has always interested me about aliens or space travel is the fact that Earth has always been this, and it's been shoehorned, and there's been so many ideas as to why this is, but, you know, they had to figure out a way to make Earth this kind of nexus for space travel.
Yes, indeed.
Where all hell always breaks loose on Earth, whether it be the Kree, the Skrull, the Kryptonians, the, you know, anybody from any of the various Green Lantern Sector 2814 worlds, it's all going to happen on Earth.
Oh, yeah. You've got the Vagans coming in from the DC Universe, or you have the Shi'ar coming in from Marvel.
The Thangar, the Ran, the Kree, anybody who you can think of, they're going to show up on Earth and start some shit. That's what
happens. Dominion, for example, which we'll get into them later. Don't get me started on Dominion.
The daddy long legs of the alien races, the Dominion. Draw your own conclusions from where I'm going with that. I kind of have developed this long-standing idea that here in the South or you know up north, what would be down here, this giant Love's truck stop of the universe. That's what Earth is.
Absolutely, and as a benefit or whatever the opposite of that is, we get a whole lot of space traffic, and we get to encounter, by accident or design, all manner of aliens. If you go back to the earliest Spider-Mans, mm-hmm. I think in Spider-Man 2 or 3, there was a character, the Tinkerer, who turned out to be an alien.
Well, everybody either turned out to be an alien or a mutant in those days. Nobody was really developing any other. There were two wells right next to each other, and if one well was too crowded, you had to go to the other well. So it was either mutant or alien.
But the more I thought about, you know, the approach we were taking, I didn't really want to talk about space and space travel and space being so much as the title implies, space race came to me, because I wanted to talk about all the just diverse and wonderful and often ridiculous alien races that we get to encounter as a result of either Earth being that nexus, or at least opening those doors. Getting out there into space and discovering all these other alien races.
Right, right. And that's important. And it's important in the sense that the most asinine why reasons have been used to go into space, or people that should never go into space are often thrust into space. The biggest culprit of this, I think, are the X-Men.
To make that even more viable, it seems you had to have a relative in space already.
Right, you either had to have a long lost dad, or an uncle, or a crazy bird lover out there in space that you had to go visit. Should we even start with star jammers?
I'm afraid that you tipped that.
I have. We have walked right into star jammers. Is that what they were called? Is that what they were called?
They were called the Star Jammers. If you look at a certain, I think it was the first issue of Longshot, there's a raging debate on whether a group of kids are the Star Jammers or the Star Slammers, which is an easy confusion to make, because around that time there was a graphic novel, The Star Slammers. And speaking of asinine, this whole, we're the Star Jammers. No, we're the Star Slammers. Shut up. Does nothing. It has nothing to do with the story. And then you find a bunch of diamonds and you're going to go trade them in for comics. What the hell? Can you tell I was deeply hurt by
you
the first issue of Longshot?
You were injured by the first issue of Longshot. And Longshot wasn't even an alien.
Yeah, that's its sole connection is this ridiculous
he was alternate universe origin story. He was a pretty cool character, though. He had some great hair. I'll give him that. Yeah.
But the Star Slammers, I believe, were created by Walt Simonson. So, you know, they got that going for them.
That's good stuff. No, but the Star Jammers featured a group of space pirates. What was their whole purpose in life? I never understood it.
I think what their purpose was for future generations to discover those issues of X-Men because of movies like, the upcoming Days of Future Past or X-Men First Class or even, you know, some of the previous X-Men films, cartoons, and other incarnations, and start backtracking because the back issues are bound to be cheaper than the new issues. And in the course of that, their purpose was so that there would be this initial knee-jerk reaction. I liked it better the first time when it was called Firefly.
Oh, jeez.
And then the realization that, no, chronologically, huh.
Right. Now, I'm a big, because Corsair was the pirate captain of the
yes.
Star Jammers, who was a Summers. How many?
Yeah, he was Scott. He was a Havoc and Cyclops' absentee dad. Scott and Alex's absentee dad.
How did that work? Was he like Starman?
I think he. the story that he gave was he went out for a pack of smokes one night.
Right.
And was abducted by aliens and subjected to all manner of tortures and then later escaped and became a space pirate. The reality was that he never got his head out of the clouds.
Right.
And, you know, he was dreaming of being Captain Jack 60 years before that ever was a thing. And when the opportunity arose where he saw, I think maybe, you know, their ship had dropped by Earth, Chaod had to get out and take a piss. And he just hopped ship.
I wasn't sure that Chaods, whatever race Chaods are, actually.
I don't know. Yeah, the big reptile guy with the
right frog people, whatever he was.
With that little thing, he's got on his shoulder. He carries this little white version of those things that you used to buy. That was the little furry thing with the Google eyes on a string
right.
on a piece of fishing line
that would shake when
you could like sort of. Yeah, and you could kind of, you know, wind the line around your fingers and pull it, and it would look, oh, look, my little pet is squirming through here. But he had one of those, except it was alive.
So I've got a question for you. Kryptonians.
Okay.
Worst alien race or the worst alien race?
That's a tough call, because for one, first thing is, which incarnation are you talking about? If you go back to the parent incarnation, the very first.
Right.
You have to look at them as this sort of entity, as a people. They're a race that is so full of themselves that anyone who thinks other than just the absolute nothing to worry about is, you know, you get this serious Cassandra syndrome because nobody wants to believe anything because they've had it so good
right.
for so long. It's almost like that, like that mad scientist from the episode of Super Friends that wanted to figured that robots would be a benefit to mankind because then they would do all the work and everyone could have leisure time without realizing the economics of that.
Right.
You know, it worked great on paper, Dr. Commie, but
Dr. Marx.
That's right. But, you know, at the end of the day, it wasn't happening. Of course, the fallacy was, of course, the robots were malfunctioning or something like that. But, you know, there would have been anarchy and chaos regardless.
But also, I mean, they're liars. And what I mean by that is, how many times have they told us that we're all dead? And then there's another Kryptonian pop up.
Oh, that's true. Now, I think you could, in some cases, chalk that up to statistical error.
No, I'm not chalking it up to nothing. They,
so you think they know absolutely. It's not exactly a small planet. It wasn't like, you know, Planet Walton's mountain blew up.
Well, it's like, it would be like
if I
won the lottery.
There were only 150 of them and everyone knew each other.
It'd be like if I won the lottery. And all of a sudden, I had relatives from Florida that I never knew I had showing
up
at my door, you know?
I guess that's what happened. Once word got out, that retroactively everyone was sending every
right
all their offspring and all their pets and anything else they had laying around the house. Because there was that one issue of, I think it was Man of Steel, where a Kryptonian sofa arrived.
It was an IKEA. I guess. Kryptonian IKEA delivered.
Yeah, it was just, I guess, whoever's sofa that was, they thought they wanted to be sure that that arrived and maybe their ship crashed into a meteorite or something. But at least their sofa made it okay. And I think Clark later put it in the Fortress of Solitude because it was actually a fold-out. So it was real handy in case Batman visited or something.
Right, right. In case Plastic Man went on a bender.
You just sort of wind him up like an extension cord and toss him on the sofa.
Toss him on the sofa. See, my other problem with this idea, right, is I feel like all these other planets, and it works for the time stream as well, but I'm just going to focus on the planets now since we did the time stream last issue.
Oh, yeah.
All these other planets kind of send us their half-ass heroes. You know, like they kind of send us the they don't send us the best and the brightest. Let's put it that way. Like the ones that got lost on the way to the bathroom end up on Earth. You know, like that's the way I feel. Like, you know, you're the last one of your race. That doesn't mean that you're the best one of your race.
It's sort of like if the Burgess Meredith in the Twilight Zone episode not only had a spare pair of glasses, but a rocket ship. And, you know, just because he's the last guy around doesn't mean he's the guy we want around.
Right. Exactly.
You know, do you want this guy coming to your planet and having superpowers?
Like Martian Manhunter, I feel like he's a good asset to Earth.
Yeah.
But I think they could have done better. I think they could have done better. That's all I'm saying.
I don't know, though. Being a shapeshifter, who can say with certainty, but he's ripped. I mean, you know, you could wound up with some slob.
Well, why wouldn't you be if you were a shapeshifter?
That's rather where I defeated my own purpose. Otherwise, you wind up looking like those blue-skinned aliens from the Teen Titans storyline I'm going to get to in a little bit.
Why don't you get to it now?
Oh, that's a good idea.
Why don't you go for it?
Well, I think you bring up a really good point in that when it comes to introducing space, the concept of spacefaring and alien races and the like, when you bring that to bear, you can do it so right or you can do it so wrong.
Right.
And very often it is done very wrong.
Yes. That
the biggest problem I have is it's unusual that someone will go ahead and tap what's already there. It seems like we're going to drive off into space and we're going to meet another new alien race we've never seen before. Apparently they were, about 5 years behind the last 17 invasions.
Well, it's the speed of light, right?
I guess it's
speed
like
of sound, the word doesn't get back to you that.
Oh, yeah, it's a lot slower. Plus, it's like, you know, the guy in charge of the helm is like the dad in Revenge of the Nerds. Got the old cruise control sit on 35.
It's the Clark Griswold of comms agents.
So, you know, done right. The other thing is that when you get into a situation, John Byrne was notorious for this. If the FF ever went into space, there'd be like 5,000 alien races in the background that you've never seen.
Right.
And nobody that you've seen being represented, even though that information was readily available in the Marvel back in the Marvel Universe books.
And you'll never see them again. That's the thing.
Exactly. And most of them look like, you know, John Byrne's love child with H.R. Geiger or something.
Yeah, we'll get into that.
But done right, you get a kind of synergy between writer and artist where you get a good set base of characters. And a good mix of that kind of intermingled with that not happening was when, I think it was in like the mid-20s of the new Teen Titans, when Wolfman and Perez were really starting to feel their powers on this title.
They were hitting
stride. And they took the fight off the Earth, had Starfire encountering her evil sister, because, you know, everybody's got to have an evil
Black
sibling.
Ice or whatever her name was.
Blackfire.
Of course it was. I can't ever remember what it was called. Probably blocked it out.
Yeah, and of course they all had the these weird derivative names that all ended in double R's. Like, you know, she was Coriander. He's Icy. And I love the fact that her father's name was Meander.
he was the comms agent on that ship.
Yeah, that's right. That's why it took so long for the for her race to make it.
For word to get back.
But the essentially what had happened was, you know, because Starfire and Robin were dating in a big way. And so, you know, that raised the ire of the Titans. So they all, they try to elicit the help of the Justice League. And luckily, as it happens, Superman is playing host to the Omega Men, who are actually from the Vega star system.
Well, coincidence be thy name.
Yeah. And plus, the sofa had just arrived. So it's a big sofa. So it folded out and held all of the Omega Men, including Brute. But, you know, what was neat about that story is once they got really heavy into it, outside of the Omega Men, you had a handful of set races that were represented.
Okay.
Because they were going up against this, the Citadel. and its leader. And all the guys from the Citadel were these great, chunky, bluish, purplish guys who like to wear a lot of gold and fezzes. And they're just these big, bulbous, two-fingered monstrosities. And, you know, there was also this sort of implied hierarchy as well. And then there were the Gordanians or the Gord... the Gordanians, I think it was.
Okay.
Which they... I think they may have been four-armed, but they may have just had two arms. Anyway, they're great big reptile froggy-looking guys. Kind of chaotish. Who all wore this big, you know, gold armor with all these spikes and stuff. And
right.
And then you had, there was one representative of a race called the Scions, who are these kind of reptilian-looking, scrawny guys dressed as Brainiac. And, you know, who were the, I guess, you know, if you have a certain intellect, it's kind of like, you know, Dr. Venture's speed suit. Pretty soon that everybody just pretty much chooses the same apparel. Once they hit that level of intellect, it's just, you know, you're not so worried about what you're wearing, so you just grab a speed suit
right.
Because he's getting in and out of
it. It's whatever's in the closet.
Yeah, and you do like Einstein. You have six of the same suit.
Just make it easy. Just don't have to worry about it. Once you're that smart.
One for each day of the week and one for the weekend. And then you have this other race called the Branks, who are these kind of big purple guys with massive tusky underbite. And four arms and big parkas.
So they're walrus people.
I guess
people.
They came from a... Yeah, I guess they came from a really hot world, and so they were just cold all the time. Like,
right,
you know,
that's
there's
always
that one guy in the office who's
I need
always,
to comment on that. I need to yeah. comment on that. That was always the funniest thing to me in one of the funniest things was if you got somebody that was a cold-based villain or hero... or a race, an alien race, anything yeah. like that. They always had to be represented wearing these giant parkas.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like giant parkas and face masks and looking like Han Solo on Hoth. And the thing is, they're like in L.A. now, you know? Like, guys,
yeah.
guys, where you're from is cold. You have cold powers. That doesn't mean that you're cold right now.
Yeah, exactly.
It's 110 in the shade, buddy.
I guess the idea with, like, Captain Cold is he wears that ridiculous parka, even, like, if he's doing a job, like, down in Miami in June.
Right.
But the thing about it is it's okay because he provides his own air conditioning.
But does it – he has a gun. So it's at arm length.
Oh, that's true. I guess he just has to shove it down his pants and give
right?
it –
Right? Like, he has no – he isn't cold. The thing that comes out of the front of the gun,
yeah,
which is facing away
true.
From him, is cold. He should be buck naked.
He suffers from his own, basically. I think somebody needed to have done a story where he just passes out from heat exhaustion.
Right. Like, he's fighting
you know,
the
he's
flash.
He's getting dizzy and falling over and you know –
Why do you think he likes fighting the Flash so much? Because the Flash does that whirlwind thing, and he's like, oh, thank
God. Yeah.
Oh, thank God.
And he's just, like, shooting randomly. He doesn't care. He knows he's not going to hit the Flash. He just wants to win.
He's not trying for anything. He's under contract to wear this thing.
Yeah.
And he just needs to cool off. That's what it is.
Whoever made the gun made him wear that.
Can somebody take me to space, please, and just drop me off for a while? Upper atmosphere.
I want to go to the Citadel planet where it's so cold. So I'm guessing that the Branks were from a really, really tropical planet, because there's always like that one person in the office that's cold all the time.
Right. This guy's got a cardigan on. It's August. Yeah. Like that was that guy. That was that guy.
That's an entire race representing that guy in comic form. But what was so cool about that is throughout that story arc, and it was one of the longest, most involved they had at that point, because most of the storylines were only like one or two issues, you saw these same these four principal races over and over and over again. And they stuck to that. And, you know, occasionally you would encounter the other races, like the ones that the various Omega Men were from, if memory serves. But for the most part, you had a finite group that you were working within. And to me, that was brilliant, because they could have just gone all out and every time you turned a corner it was a new set of aliens.
Right, but they continued the continuity.
Yes. That was an example of it done right. And of course there are myriad examples of that same concept being just completely done to death and done wrong.
Well, okay, so I have two alien race issues.
Okay.
I have a lot now. I have a lot of... I'm an alien racist, apparently. I have a lot of alien race issues, but two come to mind immediately. Number one is... When was it? When was it? 82. Okay? So 1982. The creative team behind the Uncanny X-Men get together. And they're like, well, you know, we can't introduce a 375th member of the X-Men yet. And... you know, the story, we've just got the continuity convoluted enough to drive off a whole bunch of readers. So we want to keep that where it is. What else can we do? Well, I've been thinking a lot about plagiarism. Yeah, have you? what direction do you think this should go? Well, you know, I went to the movies over the weekend, and I saw this really great movie called Aliens. And I think maybe we should just rip it off wholesale and shove it in our comic book. Okay, that's great.
Yeah, because all I could think of while I was watching it is, what if this happened to Wolverine?
Right. I mean, it's a cool concept, okay? I want to know, there has to be a backstory here on how they got away with it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it is a blow-for-blow ripoff. We're talking about The Brood, in case you haven't figured this out, guys. It's a blow-for-blow ripoff of H.R. Giger. Now the director has completely escaped me. How is that possible?
Yeah, or if you go back to Alien with Ridley Scott.
Yeah, Ridley Scott and H.R. Giger. And it's a total ripoff, down to the way they look, the way they act, how they procreate, the fact that they have
It was queen. Essentially Alien with... a spoken language, you know, where the your xenomorphs, if you will, had a spoken language.
Right. So what I don't understand, so they invaded Earth, essentially, right?
Yeah.
And the X-Men had to stop them. Okay. But why are you so out of creative ideas that you pretty much just wholesale rip off a movie?
I think, you know, when that happens... to be quite honest, and this isn't the only example of that happening, but it is certainly one of the most blatant and obvious. And I think that when that happens, it's you literally hit the nail on the head in your description, because they, you know, this was during Dave Cockrum's run,
mm-hmm.
And I think for Claremont and Cockrum, it was, you know. What would the X-Men take on this be?
Who was the EIC of Marvel back then?
I think that was that had to be during the Shooter years.
It did,
easily.
Didn't it? So,
and that very well. I never thought about that. That easily could have been an editorial mandate.
Let's imagine a coked out gym shooter going and seeing aliens, coming to Claremont and Cochram and saying, I got this great idea. You just put it in the X-Men. Oh, we got an aliens. We just did aliens invading like 2 weeks ago. We had the Shi'ar. Shut up. Listen.
No, this will work because like the Shi'ar were there too. And
just put them
they
in
brought
it.
Them.
Just put them in it. It'll be fine. And then it's like the movie Aliens, but they're not. But they're exactly the same.
But they're more like shit. More insect-like, and they're bugs, and they've got wings, so they're different.
So they're totally different. I mean, they're the same, but they're totally different. Okay. So I have now come to terms with what happened. I've talked it through.
Yeah.
I know what happened. Until I find out that Shooter wasn't the EIC, I'm going to imagine it's Shooter's fault, which I'm going to have a t-shirt made that said it's Shooter's fault, and I'm going to wear that t-shirt everywhere.
And proudly.
And proudly at that.
And the thing about it is, once the Brood were established, it just became, literally speaking, ripping things off wholesale, then it just became like wholesale Brood. I mean,
everywhere.
They kept coming back. It was essentially a one-shot type of character that should have just gone away. And it came back in the New Mutants. It came back in, I'm pretty sure somehow it must have affected the Avengers or somebody, because there's all kinds of references to the Brood.
Oh, it's still, they're still being referenced. It's still happening. Like, we're in an age now where we have these amazing comic book writers. And I'm not saying that there weren't amazing comic book writers back then. You know, there were. Obviously, there were.
Yeah.
But you've got guys like Fraction and Rucka and just amazing storytellers, and you're gonna go with the Brood, like, and continue to go with the Brood up until now. Like, you're not telling an original story anymore, and it kind of pisses me off that it was a complete ripoff that's continuing.
I will point out that in the midst of all that. And yeah, that was just blatant plagiarism, for lack of a better. But one of the things that did come out of that, there were some neat concepts, amongst which were, you got a lot more coverage of the Imperial Guard of Shi'ar, so you got to see a little bit more of that. And then there was this other concept that the Shi'ar utilized the cybernetic giant space fish,
yeah,
as a means of transportation, to the point where I think, you know, apparently you can somehow keep this thing alive but controlled like some sort of, like, you know, cockroach with an implant, and still like have it swallow the Starjammer ship and somehow you're able to, I guess, get down into the guts from up at the control panel up at the top of its head.
Little Moby Dick action going on there.
Yeah, it really was.
Little Gregory Peck in...
But yeah, the Brood kept on coming, because they came back during... at least some several other artists' tenures, as I recall.
Oh, yeah. Maybe. So my other issue is with the Skrull.
The Skrulls are a tough one.
The Skrulls have a long and storied past with the Marvel Universe. Generally speaking, I like the Skrull. Like, the Skrull are a good foil, right?
Yeah.
But my issue is with the Skrull invasion that happened, what now, like...
Oh, yes. Now, there's where you're going to get some issues.
Like 6 or 7 years ago, I don't remember. I've got them all somewhere. So my thing is, with the Skrull, what they did was they used it as a giant in-continuity retcon, right? So
Yeah. Everything
that you knew about, like, half of the Marvel Universe was wrong, because it was the Skrulls abducting people and then placing their sleeper Skrull agents in their place, right? These people that knew they were Skrull, but we're infiltrating our superhero society the entire time because Reed Richards pissed him off in, like, Fantastic Four 6. or whatever it was. Well, I'm granted, he exploded their home world. That will really set anybody off. But so what we have is things like Hank Pym not really being an alcoholic and a wife beater. You know, that was just the Skrull. Things like Wolverine and Dracula. You know, anything you can think of from that time period with almost any major Marvel character was a Skrull, not a...
Yeah, you essentially got all of the history.
Right.
In one fell swoop.
Are you, as the Skrull High Commander, right, going to let the Skrull back into your race? They've essentially become native.
Yeah.
Right, because no Skrull in their right mind is going to become an alcoholic Hank Pym wife beater.
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense. Like, what is the goal there? Like, No, you've gone native. You've gone Earthling, which is really...
Yeah,
because once
you've
embraced Earthling,
too much, you got a hold of the go-go juice there, and you just... You went all in, and you have ceased to be a Skrull.
Right, exactly. So when the big Skrull invasion goes down, everything is revealed and the big Skrull invasion goes down, and you're like, ha-ha, now what do I do? I can't go fold myself back into Skrull society.
Yeah.
I can't stay on Earth. They all want to kill me. So what do I do now? So I think that there needs to be a sub-Earth Skrull civilization somewhere for these guys, these poor bastards.
Kind of a Skrull support group or something.
Right.
You know, where they can all just sort of get together and try to adjust to this life. Or you know, maybe even like somebody taking them in.
Right. But that's my problem with the Skrull is there's this... They didn't factor that part into the story.
Well, they didn't factor a lot of things into the story. Not the least of which was, like you were saying, you effectively have gutted everything. And so we're supposed to imagine for all these decades that Hank Pym and all these others have just been sort of, you know, sitting on ice. And then they have to come back and, you know, discover what an ass their counterparts were, or, you know, to find out what deeds they supposedly did that people are going to want more.
Right. Thank God I'm home and I'm with my family. What?
Like, don't you touch me, you bastard. Like, all I've thought about for the last 10 years was holding you in my arms. Well, you should have thought about that when your doppelganger beat me.
Beat me or made me go make him a sandwich while I was working.
Yeah, I don't know how to think anymore about anything.
Like, everything, it's horrible. Oh, man. So what are the best? Like, when has this been done right? Like,
funny thing is, to go back to the Skrulls, I think the whole concept of the Kree-Skrull War...
Right.
That, you know, to get your earthly heroes embroiled in an intergalactic conflict on that scale...
Yeah.
...is pretty freaking amazing. And you know, that's a very high concept for its day. And to establish a kind of, intergalactic war that's been raging and suddenly Earth's caught in the crossfire. And, you know, but at the same time, the Skrulls are just such a conceit as far as characters go.
Yeah.
Because it's a simple little, you know, you can do anything you want to with them. In one of those ways that sometimes the strength of a character is also its weakness.
They're the skeleton key of storytelling.
Yes, exactly. Mystique is one of those.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, you can just sort of insert her anywhere. But then if you get people like me... Yeah. If you get people like me who think about that too much, then you're wondering about all these things. Like, you know, sure, Mystique could pretend to be somebody for long term, but eventually somebody's gonna be like, well, you know, your bowling game went to hell. Or, you know, I'm glad to see you're on the wagon, but I've never heard of anyone transitioning that smoothly to, you know, you used to be like Ron Burgundy and now you're a teetotaler overnight.
It's the whole thing where, you know, in a sitcom when one of your actresses gets pregnant, You need to hide it. Like,
yeah.
Weren't you pregnant in the last issue? Mystique! Like, oh, come on. Really?
Yeah. Because I don't care how well you research someone, you're not going to be able to mimic every little aspect of them.
Correct. Yeah, I agree. So,
because there are, especially because people are different in general, depending on who they're with.
Right. I agree.
And that's going to... So the Skrulls, you have that same sort of built-in problem where, you know, you, for one thing, the Skrulls would have to be in an eternal state of war. Because no one would ever want to be a trading partner with them. No one would ever want... There would be no chance of... And, you know, because you out of the back.
Right.
And like one of the things they did were burn Skrulls as having like their shape-shifting power was literally powered and broadcast out to them.
Right.
Which was, you know, and it was to say worse. Essentially, what suggested, you know, one of the things they did was like show different Skrulls all of a sudden losing their shape, stuck as, you know, in whatever shape they were in. And one of them was like, oh, look, the statue from the Skrull Empire is glowing. Like, okay, so what, did the statue get up in the middle of the night and get a sandwich? You know, that was the worst conceptualization of the Skrull. Unless he's got like some kind of built-in auto feeder sustain him while he sits around in one room all the damn time and hopes to get whatever intelligence he needs from that stationary position.
Right. That sandwich is there, or that that statue over there is starting to reek a little bit.
Yeah. You know, when the statue starts to decompose, it's just, you know, it's the little things like that that, I mean, granted, we're just nitpicking the bejesus.
But there's so much continuity involved with the Skrull that it gets to the point where it's hard to willingly suspend your disbelief on it. You know, if it would have been a 5-issue story arc with the Skrull, we could have we wouldn't be doing this right now. We would be like, it was a really cool concept. They did a really good job with it, and it's out. But the 60 years of the Skrull, one
yeah.
would think they would kind of figure it out.
Yeah, Kree at the very least, no matter how. Essentially, they were enemies with anyone else would spread the word, don't get involved with the Skrulls.
Right.
A bunch of shape-shifting idiots, you know, they can't be trusted.
But the Kree-Skrull War is the very definition of my idea that the Earps and the, who did the Earps go down with at Tombstone, the name of the gang, I can't remember.
Oh,
God.
Yeah.
But you're in the Earth is the outhouse between those two gangs shooting it out, you know, like,
yeah,
like you got to get you get in that outhouse and you keep your head down. You don't come out unless.
Yeah, it's
unless
literally
you
like
to.
The, you know, an overturned horse trough or a wagon on the street. It's just something to hide behind during the shootout.
You close the windows, the shutters, the doors, and you stay inside. And you put some extra. If you're the mortician in that on Earth, you start putting extra coffins out front because
that's right.
Shit's about to go down. That's. Well,
I do want to go back to the Brood really quickly because it was X-Men 166, the cover of it. I was just sort of looking at pictures of Brood, and you know the Brood were raging heavily in the X-Men at that point. And that was when Paul Smith was on the title. And I had forgotten that, you know, at that point they were going all in because Lilandra started brandishing a lightsaber.
Right.
And as I recall, at some point, everybody got beamed up.
They were really crossing all the genres at that point.
Yeah, pretty much. They just decided, screw it. You know, I think there was some point where the computer on the Starjammer ship wouldn't open the pod bay doors.
Right. No, Corsair.
Bruce Dern arrived inexplicably. It just got really...
Corsair woke up in a weird hotel room.
Yeah. So needless to say, yeah.
They really went all in with that. They.
It got a little out of hand for a while there.
They kept referring to the LMDs as replicants. I didn't know what was going on. There was a test. Nick Fury had to sit.
The other thing that I do like, though, is when you get a character who embarks on a space journey, when they head out into the worlds, I do like it when on their journey they somehow all of the galaxies align.
Yeah.
In an inexplicable way, but what you get is you get treated to this really neat tour de force of all the races, or at least some familiar races. When Swamp Thing was exiled from Earth for a lengthy story arc that could have been just dreadful, but was actually nothing short of brilliant, as he was hopping throughout the galaxy trying to, you know, get purchase on yeah. something long enough for him to figure out how to get back in the same wavelength with the Earth, he went to Ron, and there was a really cool story with Adam Strange. He went to Thangar, and or maybe it was during the actually I think it was on the thing with Ron, because there were like some Hawk folks there, so it kind of, and in fact that predated the whole, by years, the whole warfare between those two, that was major storyline for a while.
Right.
And he went to one of the coolest ones was when he wound up on the world that Medfil from the Lantern Corps was from, because then he just sort of, like, when he first arrived, trying to tap into the green when the green is the dominant force.
Right. That's the.
He just became this colossus of bodies.
That's a really cool idea.
And yeah, and it was brilliantly illustrated, because then Medfil's there trying to, you know, dismantle it and get to the find at the core of what's created this monstrosity, and is able to communicate. And it was really neat, because what Moore did was fold in the idea that Medfil's own mentor had passed away, because apparently vegetables do time out.
Right.
And
you gotta keep him in the CRISPR.
Oh, that's right.
That's what they're, yeah.
He was too prone to wearing a parka.
That's right.
But,
callback joke.
He was able to literally possess the dead body of Medfil's mentor and give him a kind of AI last, you know, rendezvous with his dead mentor.
Nothing creepy about that. It's okay.
Yeah, nothing at all. But that, what was neat about that is you had these various stops, and what was even cooler is many years later, one of them was this just elaborate prose thing where he landed on this, had stopped on this world where all the vegetation was blue, and he spent a lot of time there and just about went mad in the solitude.
Yeah.
And then it was, at one point, he was like, you know, created two bodies and was playing chess against himself. There was a really cool description of the Doppler image of him seeing through two sets of eyes.
That's Alan Moore, man.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah, it got very Alan. But what was amazing, and I'm trying to rack my brain, what the hell was the book? But years later, somebody wrote a story that took place on that world.
Oh, man. We'll have to do some research and find it.
And what was amazing about that story, the chess pieces were like 40 feet high.
Oh, man. Because you have no concept of...
This just got even cooler, because everything he did was on a colossal scale. And it was so amazing. Because if you knew what that was referencing, it was nothing short of the most brilliant recall
nod
I've ever seen. And if you didn't, it was just cool that they've encountered somebody who made a giant chess set, apparently.
That's awesome. Hey, guess what?
Are we coming up?
We are
coming up on it.
There's so many other things that I wanted to talk about, and we're coming
gonna
up
be
on it
for this again, I'm sure. I guess, you know, really bottom line for me is that I like when you get recurring races.
Okay.
And that was one of the neat things. I mentioned the Marvel Universe, which was the guidebook at the time, that you got in the back of every issue was like about a dozen different alien races represented, apparently in their underpants.
Right.
So you could get an. But what was so neat about that is all of a sudden you're like, you saw the familiar and you saw the unfamiliar, and occasionally you'd come across the comics they were in, or you'd see where their first appearance was, and maybe you were kind of interested to see what they were, or you found out the Brood don't wear underpants.
They have built-in underpants.
Yeah, they do. But, you know, the fun thing was that sometime later, or was to find out that alien races that were fairly recently introduced were turning up as well. In the, who was it? Babyface Bob Layton, was it, who did the Hercules miniseries? For, essentially, it was Hercules creating the plot of the first Thor movie.
Yeah.
Where he gets kicked out of Olympus
right.
for lack of humility. And forced to wander the stars in this case until he learns his lesson. And in one of the episodes, he encounters Galactus and winds up, who wants to eat this world, which I didn't catch the joke at first. It was the homeworld of the Seagramites.
Oh, man.
Because of the way it was spelled. And I didn't realize that the planet was, of course, Seagram. Seven.
Seagram 7. I remember that. I remember
that. The Distiller's World. And essentially, Hercules winds up drinking Galactus under the table to get him to leave the Seagramites alone.
Right. Well, Hercules, that affront cannot stand. You cannot eat the Distillery World.
Oh, yeah. It was either drink him under the table or punch him in the balls.
Until he fell down.
That's right. He offered him a choice of either a drinking game or rolling Shambo.
That's my favorite carnival game, punch Galactus in the balls till he falls down.
Yeah, but it's rigged.
It's totally rigged. Galactus doesn't have balls. It's totally rigged. God. See, the thing about this, and we've talked about this before, is... if done correctly, and I will say this about the Kryptonians or about a lot of these races where you got one left, you know, the one guy left, or despotic alien races, if used as a cipher for social commentary and done well, it works, and it tells a story, and it's like all good sci-fi. If used in that through that lens, and you tell that story... Kryptonians didn't pay attention to the environment, or you know what I mean?
Yeah, and they didn't heed the dangers that were patently in front of them.
Right. So their world was destroyed. You know, if you're looking at something like that, if you're looking at it from a racist or a war is bad, you know, Kree-Skrull war, there are innocent bystanders whenever you go to war. There's no such thing as a good war. That type of idea, of course it's good. They tell a good story. Not all of them are good.
Yeah. And sometimes even the worst possible alien race can transcend that designation in the form of the best possible cipher for social commentary. And I'm going to go out on a big limb here.
Oh, here we go.
I was personally surprised years ago. I got into this title because they did a two-part Star Wars semi-parody that I didn't realize was actually social commentary rich.
Okay.
Then I got involved with the title and began to really see some sophisticated social commentary that was amazingly layered in the guise of an unlikely, ridiculous alien visiting or, you know, being basically in a forced exile on Earth. None other than, believe it or not, Howard the Duck.
Yeah.
And I'm sure if you've seen the movie, it left a bad taste in your mouth with good reason. But if you get a chance, go and get the essential Howard the Duck, or go find the original Gerber issues. And you'll find some amazing social commentary that's also rich with humor.
Right. So there you go. There is a recommendation at the end of Hey Kids Comics.
There you go. Well, and we're not all bitter and angry about everything.
No.
The Brood and the Dominion, notwithstanding,
Right. Well, we'll get into the Dominion in another show. I don't understand. They must have the strongest spines in the world to hold up.
And the only other real problem I have is when you take the Superman strange visitor from another planet with powers and abilities, and you amplify that 100-fold and create the Legion of Superheroes.
Right.
My biggest problem with the Legion of Superheroes is, okay, everybody in the, especially in the inaugural group, had the same powers as absolutely every one of their species.
Right.
Whether they were on Earth or not. Regardless of where Cosmic Boy goes, or anyone else, or his brother, his cousin, his best friend, that guy he couldn't stand in homeroom.
Right.
His teacher, his old boss at his first job, every single one of them has some degree of magnetic powers. What sets you apart as Cosmic Boy? Why do you get to be Cosmic
Boy?
Because
I was saying.
Were first.
That's what I was saying. That's when they send, you know, you could have sent better guys. You know.
Exactly.
Everybody on your planet has the same powers. This guy shows up.
I want to see the guy with Cosmic Boy powers, but he also, you know, can shoot stinging foam in your eyes or
right
something. You know, Cosmic Boy, everybody else in the world plus. You know, he's the one who stands out, and it's a shame that he left the planet to go run around with these other guys.
Right, but it's understandable because he was gifted.
But the other side of that was, I think it was an invasion or something like that in DC.
Okay.
For some reason, Daxam, which was the exact same, it was like, you know, practically a sister planet to Krypton that didn't get blowed up. For some reason, the Daxamites in, you know, then contemporary time versus the Daxamites in Legion of Superheroes time, because I think like Mon-El or somebody was Daxamite or one of those guys, Ultra Boy or anyway, I'm sure there are Legion people. Starman's shaking his head, saying no. But at any rate,
Starman's freaking out right now.
There was one thing where like a whole shipload of Daxamites arrive on Earth, and they open the pod bay doors, and all of a sudden, all of them are just flying out under their own power and just reveling in suddenly discovering they're a ship full of Superman.
Right. I do remember
that.
That
was a
cool
take on, you know, absolutely everybody would have that power, but, you know, all of a sudden, like, everybody's like, dang, I'm glad I took this trip.
Right.
I almost stayed home.
All right. Plug it up. Plug it up.
Yes, you are, of course, been listening to the this another great episode. Thank you again to Andy for, you know, just making this amazing show happen here on the Jedi Cole Universe at JediCole.com, home of more podcasts than you can shake a stick at, and more on the way. You can get our occasional tweets on at the Jedi Cole U.
Twerts.
You can certainly write to us if you're so inclined, and please do. No one ever does.
No one writes, no one calls.
Yeah, at jcumail@yahoo.com. And you can find us also, occasionally you can find myself and some of the other local denizens of the JCU at various conventions. And even if we're not there, you can find out about all kinds of conventions in Texas at Convention Awareness Project Texas. At conventionawarenesstx.blogspot.com. For the first time, I was able to say that in one breath and right. And I don't know what happened that I'm so concise all of a sudden. And finally, because we are about to make this magic happen yet again, you can also find us over at the United States of Geekdom at unitedstatesofgeekdom.com.
You can also find him this Sunday. This Sunday?
This Sunday, yeah.
Live? Because this is the next Sunday?
Oh, my gosh. Is it? This Sunday or next Sunday? Oh, yes, this Sunday, yes.
This Sunday.
The second episode of the Rancor Pit Live at Deep Ellum on Air. If you miss the live show, which is 11 a.m. to noon Central, we are on a live feed with a phone number, which I do not have at the moment, but we will publish that on the JCU site before in advance of Sunday, because I really we got a real kick out of some of our JCU friends calling us in. Myself and Eddie Medina, we have every other week on the JCU, the Rancor Pit, and on the opposing weeks over at Deep Ellum on Air, we have the Rancor Pit live, and
there
we are on a live stream, which has just been, we are both cannot wait for Sunday to get here.
All right. So next week we will have another episode. I think we're finally, we might get that footage back from the Smithsonian. We're still trying.
Yeah.
We've got Freedom of Information Act requests in.
We have top men working.
If not, expect a revisitation of a possible first story arc from us. We want to go back and look at what we've done and how far we've grown and come as podcasters and people and see
and
if we've changed our opinion.
Discover, what have we, how do we differ from back then?
Right. So thank you guys for listening and participating and being a part of the Jedi Cole universe and a part of the Hey Kids Comics family. We couldn't appreciate it more. Stay tuned next week for more exciting adventures in Space Race. Space AIDS. Space AIDS, dude.
Space. Moon cheese.
It's got moon cheese. Moon grill cheese. I'm telling you, that deli on off of Centauri that Yondo goes to.
Oh, yeah.
Best moon grilled cheese.
Some awesome moon grilled cheese. It's bits of moon sprinkled in.
Yeah, you got to be careful, though. You might chip a tooth. Moon grilled cheese, moon grilled cheese, moon grilled cheese, moon grilled cheese, moon grilled cheese. All right. I think I'm ready.
Snake skin chips.
Snake skin chips, moon grilled cheese, snake skin chips, moon grilled cheese.